welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. It's good to be here with you at OC Talk Radio. Paul, today is my New Year's resolution episode, and it's already more than 2 weeks. 2 weeks late, that is. I fear that we may be seeing a start of a projection of how my New Year's intentions are going to come to pass this year, which is late. In my Myers-Briggs personality style inventory, I fall into the class that defines on time as always late. I've thought about it and have determined that the deadlines associated with so many of our New Year's goals are really false goals because they're pretty much established rather arbitrarily the moment we made up these goals. Our guest today, my dear friend Terry Hershey, who is endowed with my same personality defects, writes, "For me, the word deadline simply means it's time to get started." We both believe in that deadlines in truth are really just guidelines. I know of no one better to talk to about setting the New Year's resolutions than Terry Hershey. As you know, or may not, we did the same kind of show last year, and as I recall, Terry, we totally poo-pooed the notion of New Year's resolutions. Well, enter a new year and a new decade, and I feel differently. I believe that the new year and that the new decade provides a grand opportunity for reflection on the past and a promising introduction to the future. Only for me, I personally have altered the term goals to intentions. I like the word intentions because it feels a bit softer, perhaps, for those of us who have the deadline versus guideline malady. So today, Terry and I will explore what our intentionally lived lives in 2020. But before I bring Terry on, I want to quote one of my favorites, Seth Godin, who recently wrote, and I like this, "For most of us, 2020 will be a turning point because it's another chance to live tomorrow over again, a chance to reset, to decide what's important and what's worth working for. To me, all of us in America would benefit by taking a moment to reset, decide what's important and what is worth working for." So let's bring on Terry. Yo, Hirsch, welcome to the show, bud.
Hey, Charles. Oh, yeah. I don't remember last year. Did we? I don't remember.
I know. That's hard. That's hard. We're going to talk about age later. Is it? Yeah. Now, tell me, since I'm never on time, is it too late to wish you a happy new year?
No, because, and here's why, because I celebrate, that song that we don't ever like about Christmas, the 12 days of Christmas. Well, the 12 days of Christmas ends on January 6th. So I celebrate all 12 days. So that the new year doesn't start to me till January 7th.
So we're just a day late.
Yeah, perfect timing.
Perfect, perfect. Now, although you and I share what I might term a mutual disdain for traditional New Year's resolutions routine, it's fascinating that both of us separately, independently, seem to have succumbed to entering 2020 with a bit of reflection and thoughts about how we might approach the oncoming year as well as decade. In your most recent entry on Sabbath Moment a couple of days ago, you reflected a distinct consideration about your interior self. Tell me, what inspired you to write that letter? I know that was a difficult letter for you to write.
Well, I don't know if I was interested in resolutions per se.
Although they certainly did come out.
Did they?
Yeah.
Well, again, you know what? That's fair. It's fair to have times in your life when you ask questions, and questions invite us to be awake and alert, and more importantly, to take ownership. And so, in other words, I'm not living my life reactive in some way. So, it's good to, you take the stuff that you have, you sort through it, and you say, is this me, is this mine? And do I choose to give an honor, use the word honorably, I love that. Do you know what honor literally means? It means to weigh heavy. I love that.
Yeah, that is wonderful.
To weigh heavy. And so, yeah, and so then you ask the question, in other words, and the truth is, if I'm going to be, and yeah, it was a hard one to write because I have to ask the question. If I'm going to ask, is this me, and this is this something I wish to honor, I choose to honor, whether it's a part of me or a part of the life I've chosen, if that's true, then that takes some come to Jesus moments, and that's a good thing.
You know, that really fits, because I think much of our discussion, as I have thought through, will be a matter of what we choose to honor. And it seems to me, when you're talking about asking questions, that you are participating in what the suggestion that Maria Rinera Rilke quote is said, live the question, and you really are indeed living the question. What does that mean to just live out the question with it ever coming in your mind?
Yeah, well, part of it is that you first of all, if you're gonna pay attention to whatever it is, who am I? What am I honoring? What is significant or important to me? What choices am I making that are of value in this life? Then I have to begin with the fact that I own my life. I am not reacting to it. Nothing else owns me. Nothing else makes me do something. Well, that's a big deal. And so I have to take responsibility now. Well, in other words, no one can make me do something I don't choose to do.
Doesn't that take us back to Viktor Frankl?
Absolutely, 100% it does. And it's actually liberating, because Frankl said, obviously, the one thing they can never take away from me is my ability to choose. I mean, they take everything away from me.
My ability to choose how I respond, particularly.
Yeah, correct. And he's talking about his attitude.
Yeah.
His mental framework.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, I agree.
I was just looking at my notes and got lost because we got off notes, and that's fine with me. I want to get off notes. I really also liked your idea. I just expressed it to my son last night at dinner. We were having sushi, and I talked about living in the now as paying attention, and that truly is a methodology, if you will, of living in the present, and that is focusing on an act of paying attention to what is happening right now rather than thinking of what might be happening, because I don't think we're as past-oriented as we are future-oriented or distracted by so much crap that is coming across our mind. Like in meditation, you know, we call it the monkey mind. Whenever you're trying to settle down in peace and solitude, you know, you got the monkey mind, you know, just rattling off thoughts. And paying attention is a safeguard, I think, against that, in not just in meditation, but in life in general. Would you agree?
Well, the thing about paying attention, Jim Harrison, one of my favorite writers, said paying attention is the only game in town. And I appreciate that. And the paying attention, the first thing it does is it grounds me, and because it makes me aware. In other words, my senses are now invited to this moment. So I'm here. What do I see, hear, taste, touch, smell? In other words, what grounds me to this particular moment right now? Because if I'm not doing that right now, then mentally there are many things that take me away from this moment, whether it's worry or preoccupation or a variety of other things, but none of them are connected to my senses.
So tell me, when you're doing your garden, it's a It's a wonderful opportunity to pay attention, but is it? Do you find it difficult not to have those distracting thoughts, the monkey mind, going on as you're gardening, or are you just fully engaged in the process of gardening?
Well, yeah, sure. There are times when you have a monkey mind, especially if you have a to-do list, you know. But the phenomenon of gardening is that you really do. You really do pay attention.
And, it requires it, doesn't it?
It requires it.
Yeah, and that's why
and it's a powerful thing. And I mean, there's a wonderful story that was told about it was a seminar. You can appreciate this. A seminary class, a guest professor coming in, he's introduced, and the seminary happens to be neighboring an elementary school, and it's a summer day, so the windows are open. And it so happens that the guest speaker is speaking during
recess.
So the kids are playing, and it's noisy. And the professor introducing the guest speaker apologizes profusely for the noise and the interruption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It'd be so much better if we could have done this at a different time. And the guest speaker says, what you need to understand is to thank God the kids are playing, because the whole point of my lecture is, what is it about our present moment that we're paying attention to? And in other words, do you hear the children? Do you hear them playing? And our immediate sense is we have to dismiss whatever it is we're paying attention to get back on the script we have. And our script is always in our head. It's never on the ground.
And it's really not then paying attention. It is, as you said, it's following a script. And that is almost antithetical to paying attention, because paying attention is an act of surprise, an act of discovery, not an act of premeditation.
And paying attention also... I mean, also, it literally grounds you, but in a way, it almost freezes time. One of my favorite quotes about Michael Jordan, we're going back to sports now, is that they asked him about some of the shots he made. He said, in some of those moments, some of his famous shots, he said, literally, time stopped.
Yeah.
Everything was slow motion. I could see everything.
Yes, yes.
Everything was in focus. It's the same with me. I mean, whether if you're back to the garden, when you're weeding, you see the colors and you see this. And even if you see something that you say to yourself, I need to fix that part of the garden, the wonderful irony with paying attention is you see it in a way that doesn't trouble you.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, Terry, I told you I was reading this book by Ryan Holiday called Stillness is the Key. And he's talking about peace in three different in mind, spirit, and body, and he brings up the idea of leisure, and he really redefines leisure as that we often define leisure as binge watching TV or just having no responsibility or doing nothing that causes any activity. And yet he defines leisure quite differently. He would define leisure, as you called, I would say in his definition, gardening is leisure for you. It is
yeah.
Not work. It is something, you know, Winston Churchill had two leisure activities that he was adept at neither, which was bricklaying and painting. He was a horrible painter, and then they would bring on the professionals to correct his bricklaying so he wouldn't have to look at how bad it was. But it was so good for him because he was doing something physically and mentally, and it took his mind off the state of affairs, all of the conflicts that he had to deal with, and then he could just focus. And it was a focus, and it was an activity. And I think...
You know, there is a sense
of play. You use the word playing. There's a sense of play to it that is intentional.
Yeah, because I didn't know that. I didn't know that about Churchill. That's great, because Gandhi, you know what Gandhi did?
No.
You know, this was back in the day, those huge looms. He was a weaver.
Yeah.
Whenever he wanted to get away from whatever bombarded him, he would spend time in his room because it allowed him to play with thoughts and play with the things that are going on in his and what you do when you're during leisure. I think the definition of leisure is anytime you put the scorecard down.
That's a nice way to put it. That makes it very clear. Anytime you put the scorecard down, and boy, is that necessary. I find, you know, now I once found my leisure in painting, and I've just not been doing it, not for several reasons, for several reasons, but I've replaced it with my morning routines. And it's like I read of Marcel de Montaigne, who was the author who created essays in like 1570, 1550. And he resigned, in fact, himself to live in leisure. Let's see, what were the three things? Leisure, reading, and reflection. And that was what he spent his whole day doing. And that just seems like my mornings are all about reading and reflection. You know, my journaling takes me a minimum of 30 minutes every day. And I have a very good inspirational book by David White titled Consolations that just gives me wonderful ideas to write, you know, a few hundred words about. And I, as being retired, I can start working when I want, but I'm up at 6:30 and it takes till 8 or 9 o'clock for me to finish my morning routine. And I am ready for the day after that.
Yeah.
And I will not look at emails, will not answer anything if anything comes in. That whole thing, I'm off the grid. I'm totally off the grid.
Well, that's part of the keeping score has to do with checking something off the list. I mean, and so if I bring the, and that's why, you know, that's why in any of those, if I'm gardening, I cannot take my telephone with me. That would be a violation of that space.
It would be. Now, listen, let's go back to your article because I'm going to refer to your Sabbath moment that, and we won't talk about the title until the end, but it was something like the gift of mercy, was it not?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, and I really resonated personally when you wrote about your intention to aim high by making some attempt to eliminate worry as you seek inner peace. And I so agree with the latter. One of my predominant themes for this year, as it was the last quarter of 2019, is to somehow become embedded in peace and serenity. And those are just such major aspects in my life, and I have made grand improvements and have that have been encouraging for me to continue so far to go, but I love the idea of peace and serenity. I think we also hunger for peace in a world that just does not allow peace, and you know, our press is all about entertainment and confrontation and controversy. There are few places, few sanctuaries of peace.
Yeah, well, you're preaching to the choir about the sanctuary part. I mean, that's the first question I ask people is, tell me where your sanctuary is. In other words, what grounds you and makes you feel at home and makes your psyche and your spirit feel safe? That's your sanctuary. Tell me where that place is. And do you know where that is? And do your friends know where that is so they can help you go there too?
And there's an intentionality about it, is there not? I mean, it doesn't happen arbitrarily.
If you don't choose to go there, it will not happen.
Yeah, and it is habitual.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's habitual. Actually, I say it's aerobic.
Okay.
And by aerobic, I simply mean it's just something. It's something I do either daily or regularly. And by aerobic, I simply mean regardless of how well it went, I still need to do it again tomorrow.
You know, I find that, go ahead, please.
Yeah, you know, say, I mean, somebody could say, oh, man, I really sucked at my aerobic class today. It was all fine. It doesn't really matter. You're still going to do it tomorrow. That's what I love about the aerobic part. In other words, it's a part of my life that is essential, and it has nothing to do with whether or not I succeeded or failed at it.
You know, for that exact reason is why I have left the more what they call seeker-friendly and entertainment-oriented church and gone to the liturgical church of Anglicanism, because every Sunday we do exactly the same damn thing.
Correct. You know,
there are no changes. There are no changes. And I'm a very, as you know me, I'm a very change-oriented person. I like creativity and I like change, but in order for me to have the strength to change, I cannot have my roots changing. My roots must be firmly planted. And I find my Anglican church service that we do the same thing all 45, you know, I go to the early service that has no music and, you know, it's for all us old people. And I do the same thing for 45 minutes every week. And, you know, I've got the whole thing memorized, and it's not just rote. I'm taking it to heart. I'm believing it. I'm loving it. I'm so full of a sense of peace and a sense of wonder and a sense of learning, a sense of discovery. But none of it is creative. You know,
But you're not. This is the thing, Charlie, because you're not doing the same thing. That's the power of what we would call liturgy and or ritual. It's the same as paying attention. You're not. That's like me going out and weeding the same. I weed the same exact. I'm going to do the same exact thing this March I did last March, and I've done for the last 20 Marches in this garden. Same exact thing, and it's the exact same. But it's not because it creates. It's like saying, "Well, the sunset is the same sunset. Why watch it?" No. The power of the ritual is it creates a space, and the ritual actually creates a framework for freedom. So inside that framework, you can let your worry go. In other words, you don't have to worry about the framework. The worry for the framework is gone. So now you can give your mind to everything inside that, which is understanding and asking questions, just like you had said before, and understanding gratitude and confessing. And in other words, you have a weight that is off your shoulders because that liturgy, that framework, takes the weight off your shoulders.
Boy, I have never entertained those thoughts, and I think even as you explain them, I identify with them wholeheartedly. And that,
yeah, because you go, because I know how your mind can go crazy, like my mind can, but in the framework, you're like. You like go, okay, and you give yourself freedom to just check in.
That is, Jocko Willink. Are you familiar with Jocko Willink,
the
U.S. Navy SEAL, who's oh so popular today, and he's got a podcast and several books, and we're going to hear him speak. And he gets up at, you know, he has a routine where he gets up at 4:30 every morning and does, but he does his exercises in his routine. But he, I don't know if the book is titled this, but his theme is discipline is freedom.
And I would argue. And so as long as I'm not in, let's just say the liturgy is my. Let's just say it's my exercise discipline, because now I have one. I walk daily. It's X number of minutes and X number of miles, and it's daily. Now, if I turn that into some sort of a scorekeeping mentality, then it's not freedom. But if it's a liturgy for me, then it's a, and I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah, that's That's really quite a good thought. I find it interesting as well that our intentions for the year are more about that both of our intentions for the year, as I read in your The Gift of Mercy piece, and as I've thought about my intentions for the year, they're more about, you use the word interiority, I use the word accomplishments. They're more, I mean, use the word, not interiority, I'm sorry. Use the word keeping score, and I use the term accomplishments. But that both of ours are more about interiority than they are about accomplishments. And the ever-so-famous marketing guru Seth Godin that I quoted earlier wrote on a recent post, he wrote about planning heartfully with a focus on interiority for 2020. I like that. Planning heartfully with a focus on interiority as opposed to a focus on keeping score or accomplishments.
Yeah, I mean, I still get those emails, you know, from whatever they're, what are those emails called where they're trying to sell you something? Anyway, I get lots and lots of them.
Oh, I've unsubscribed to so many. I
know. So I do too, but I still get them because I find them curious, because they're always telling me I could be something and make something with my life. And I smile and I just laugh. I kind of laugh because they also tell me I'm going to make millions of dollars and also be something and make something of my life. And I don't discount their intention. They want to sell me something. That's fine. But not one of them has ever said, what kind of person do you wish to be today? With your partner.
Really?
Your son,
yeah.
With your friend, or with your enemies, for God's sake. Because, I mean, I'm having a hard time with that. Not my enemies per se, but the people I dislike.
Yeah.
What kind of person do you want to be? And when people are connect with you, rub up against you in life, are you going to leave them better off? Are you going to leave them in a better place? That's back to your interiority thing. That comes from that. It doesn't come from some assignment that I'm going to leave them better off. No, it happens because whatever is going on inside of me spills.
Yes, it does. It is reflected. Absolutely.
Correct.
You know, it's... I don't want it to sound like thinking too highly of myself, but for more than 20 years, and I probably mentioned it on the blog, I mean on the podcast in the past, that my wife and I, for more than 20 years, as you know, take three or four nights and we go on retreat. And on our retreat, we take a personal inventory of our marriage, to where we take a look at what kind of husband was I last year, what kind of wife was I last year, what could I do to make life better for you, and we really are talking about interior things. You know, what kind of behaviors, what kind of action, or what kind of heartfelt deeds can I do? And you know, there have been years, Terry, after 34 years of marriage, that we have had, you know, we've had either tears or rants or raves or anger, but it's been really beneficial. And I actually take notes. I write down what kind of husband she wants me to be, and I, you know, I do my monthly, you know, just checklists. I just review it monthly and see how am I doing at each one of those things. So I'm truly being the kind of husband. And I think. That's an interior sort of intentional interior activity that really helps us relationally. It helps my marriage relationally, so I can understand, instead of assuming what my wife thinks, I get a face to face on what my wife thinks.
Yeah, I as you know, because we've been friends for all those years, and I've always been in awe of that thing that you guys do, because I can't imagine it. I mean, Yeah, I'm not. I just.
I don't want to know.
I just switch marriages, you know. I don't have your capacity, apparently.
Oh, that's great. That's really that's really good.
No, but I mean, but I say this about anybody who has, because what you have done with that is absolutely no different than what you described with your Anglican Church situation. You guys have a liturgy. You have a liturgy, a ritual / liturgy that gives you the freedom. And, you know, it gets bumpy and you had to figure out the liturgy, but it gives you the freedom to ask questions that you wouldn't have asked at a time other than that liturgy time.
Yes, there are no illegal questions. Everything...
That's the power of that liturgy, and that's what I think is wonderfully remarkable about that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
but I'm the one that's benefited from it. I mean, it's been tremendous benefit in our marriage.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing true with you. You know, now you're in the 12-step world. Liturgy is a big deal for the 12-step world.
Absolutely, called the 12 steps, yep.
Exactly, you're in a liturgy, and it gives you the freedom now. Outside of those 12 steps, you're at the mercy of. That's the key. You're at the mercy of something. You're at the mercy of your addiction, or you're at the mercy of whatever's going on mentally in your head, or you're at the mercy of living outside of yourself.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. You wrote about that in your article, and I want to talk about what owns you in a bit, but I think you are bang on when you talk about we are at the mercy of not only other people, and it's not the other people, it's the way we perceive other people's responses to ourselves, in that we fail to use Viktor Frankl's encouragement to choose our response, that we're under that sort of influence from other people. But before we get there, I want to go just a moment back, way back, to the focus on interiority and how you and I are both really focused on that. And I'm wondering, what do you think? Do you think... as we age, this is an age thing, you know, and how old you are thing. You know, I've always, you and I, in all our letter writing and all our discussing, have endeavored, I think all the time we've been together, we've endeavored to seek and realign our exterior lives with our interior lives. But I find it is never so dominating my thinking as it does at 70 years old. Is that second half of life? Is that an age thing, or is it not an age thing? Because it's much more, it was strong younger, but it's, you know, it just dominates me now.
Yeah, no doubt about that. It's second half of, no doubt about it. And it's a wonderful thing. Now, I mean, it's available to us at the second half because... you know, we see the end, and so that puts things in perspective, and it lets you ask different kinds of questions, which is wonderful. And you're not climbing the ladders are different now at this age, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
They have handrails.
I don't think that's exactly what I was talking about, but...
No, but I'm just saying, the second half of life is you're not trying to make something of yourself that as you're trying to do in the first half of life. The second half of life, you're trying to find affirmation and meaning in the self that you've made. And you cut yourself some slack, which is great. And so I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah, I'm looking up. I wrote a post on How to Make an Impact on Your Life or something. It had a sexy title, but I can't remember what the title was. And it received quite a bit of comments, and I want to read one comment that you will find fascinating. And I'm pulling it up as I'm meandering right here. Comments, okay, I've got it coming up right here. It was written by a man that said, because it was titled "What It Takes to Find Oneself," and I was talking about second half living in doing so, and he wrote so fascinating of the article. Because of my personal experiences, when I was young, I was living Hesse's idea, because I wrote of Hermann Hesse, I was living Hesse's idea in reverse. I started off with solitude, meditation, soul-searching, quest for meaning, but now, and this man is probably 40 years old, in his early 40s, but now I'm trying to figure out the building of my real-world ego and existing in a system environment, both socially and financially, that I never really understood. And my response to him was, it's absolutely critical for your personal development to establish a strong ego. I highly encourage you continue to do so. The task falls into the category of first half living, and you are by age naturally in the first half. I'm so glad you have embraced your journey in a thoughtful manner. So there is credit to first half living, to building that ego, that we need. There's a time that we need to do that, and so in order that it establishes the foundation from which we can have second half. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, yes, with one exception. I mean,
sure.
I spent so much of my life building it on who Terry was supposed to be, who Terry should be.
Yes.
And so much of that was predicated on whatever skills I had or talents I had or whatever dreams I had or who I was supposed to be and what I was supposed to do. And
what was expected of you by others as well.
Yeah, and so there's a combination of that. In other words, but that's all mingled together. And so there's a part of that, and there are parts of that. For example, my talents are my talents, but I didn't necessarily use them for what I wanted. It was what for others wanted, et cetera. And so there's a messiness to that when you're younger. And you're still able to do things that are extraordinary, and hopefully you have gifts that you give to those around you, et cetera. But there's a time in your life when you say, you know, some of that, I mean, I'm glad I know who I am. And because now I know who I am, there are parts of my life where I can say, it's okay, I could have done that differently. Or it's okay, I apologize for that part of my life. Or it's okay, I want to make retribution. Or it's okay. In other words, you're not worried about that anymore, because that scorecard has been put down. So you can embrace those talents, and you can embrace all of the things that you expected to want and be. You can embrace all that without needing it to be the wholeheartedly who you are in that ego part of you. Your ego is not solely defined there.
Right. That's great. And I want to get to more of that, but you know, this is a longer podcast, but I am more than willing to go there. So let's take a brief break, but let readers know we're about two-thirds through. We're not half through. We're about two-thirds through or more. But let's take a brief break and come back and finish this thing off. This is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I'm with my friend Terry Hershey, and we are talking about 2020, the new year, and the new decade, and I've titled this show 2020 Lived Intentionally. We're talking about an intentionality and what are our intentions, and which is unusual for Terry and I, who have sort of resisted this New Year's resolution thing, to come to a year where we are taking on New Year's resolutions, but more interior resolutions than checklist accomplishments, but more of what I am or who I am as a person than what I accomplish as a person. Now, Terry, in this delightful, entertaining, and insightful Sabbath moment that you wrote on the gift of mercy, you write also about the desire for truth-telling by means of storytelling. You say that stories keep us sane. Can you talk to me more about stories and truth and sanity?
Yeah, well, stories that keep us sane. I mean, I didn't use the word, I didn't make that up per se, but I mean, Raven and Crow, Barry Lopez wrote a children's book, and there's an exchange between two of the people in the book who said, you need to remember your stories, you need to tell them, because sometimes we need stories more than food to stay alive.
And we need stories, repeat that please.
Sometimes we need stories more than food to stay alive.
Oh.
And stories are, now we're back to the liturgy thing. And this is something we've forgotten this, because for centuries, thousands of years, the way truth was communicated is son, daughter, family, I need to tell you a story. Community, we need to tell you a story. And here's our story, and here is the story, or one of the stories, but here's the story. The story is the liturgy that allows us to then ask ourselves, what do we value here? Where do we ground ourselves here? And what choices will we make from this here? That's the story.
You know, that's the difference between story. I've always said the story, that didactic teaching starts from the outside and works its way in. Story starts from the inside and works its way out.
100% true, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why, Terry, for years, you know, both you and I don't know the percentages, but I would say we probably read 75% fiction and 25% nonfiction, and now I am at a 100% nonfiction. I need to change that. I need to get back to reading stories again, because I learned so much from stories in such a different way. I learned so much from fiction in such a different manner than I learned from nonfiction. Nonfiction just tells me this, but it's all of a sudden just brain dump, you know? It's just like opening the top of my brain and shoveling in all this crap, you know, rather than stories that sort of mesh and engrave.
Yeah, and it's the same fight that I had, I mean, way back in seminary days, going through whether Old Testament, but primarily New Testament, but didn't really matter, any part of the Bible you went through. Back very often, one of the people wanted to fight about was this true or accurate, rather than where are you in the story?
Exactly. That is such a great question.
Where are you in this story, and what does it invite you to be and do, and what kind of person does it invite you to be, and et cetera? And instead we're having, we go way off track to your point, we go to the external part of having a fight about who is right and who is wrong, rather than the kind of people we are in the story.
Boy, and that takes you talk about biblical, that takes a big thing I learned, gosh, 15 years ago from a pastor, and when he was talking about the parables of Jesus, he says, we like to take the role of the hero in the parables when the parables were intended for us to take the role of the non-hero. Take the role and understand what we lack, not praising what we have. And too often, churchgoers take parables and praise themselves for being, I'm the sinner who asks for mercy all the time, not the high priest that thanks God I'm not like the sinner. When in reality, I thank God I'm not like the sinner.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about that second part is the what we lack part is if we're okay with who we are, and that's that second half of life thing, in other words, if I don't have to prove myself and I put the scorecard down, then there's no problem with talking about what I lack. In other words, it's not detrimental to my psyche.
No.
It's not detrimental to my identity. In fact, it's a wonderful invitation.
It is an invitation. Yes.
Guess what I get to be and do now?
Yeah. So
that's a powerful thing.
It's great insight.
That's why it so frustrates me that in our culture people are so afraid of saying that they're wrong, or that there are parts of themselves that they can say, it wouldn't hurt me to do such and such.
Boy, when I first entered the Episcopal Church, it was early on within the first year or two, Bishop Borsch approached me and he talked about, and I was a pretty strong evangelical, and so I had troubles with women in ministry, and I had troubles with gay ministry because I was taught the opposite, and the Episcopal Church accepts that, and I had troubles with a number of things, but I still found solace in the Episcopal tradition. And as I talked to the bishop about it, he says, you know, the Bible is inerrant, the Bible is true. The one thing we need to know is that we are not, the Bible may be inerrant, but we are not inerrant, and we can always be wrong. And that has stuck with me for forever, that I can always be wrong. No matter what I think, I can be wrong.
And the wonderful part about that is being wrong doesn't preclude the possibility of me having a conversation with you or making choices now to better out my life and your life.
Exactly. It's a big, another subject, but it's the big thing to me that is missing in America today is our failure to dialogue, that we can't actually talk. You know, we take sides, finger point, and blame. And both, you know, all sides are doing that rather than sitting down at a table and having conversation about it. But that's another whole other subject. Now, I want to go to your essay, and I want to go to the heart of your essay. And, I guess I'm not going to the heart of it yet. I'm still going to another part of it because there was so much in it I wanted to quote. And in your essay, you write, and I quote this. This is a quote from your essay. I choose to live fully awake and unafraid. Yes, if we live awake and unafraid, we can discover that knowing our strength is grounded in humility. Terry, that's really powerful. Fully awake, unafraid, and humility. That sounds like a powerful set of intentions, not just for 2020, but for all of life. Were you aware how strong that sentence was when you wrote it?
Kind of, only because of the people who I unbelievably admire, who were willing to say in their life, I was wrong. In other words, the power of who I am as a person and the role that I play in this world and the difference I can make is not predicated on me being right or the top or the winner.
That is second half living. You just defined second half living. So as we're coming to a close, your Sabbath moment was all about mercy, and I've neglected to mention that because you had so many other points that I wanted to make. But there's just another few sentences that I must quote because I can't paraphrase them well as you stated them. I must quote because I found them so striking. So this is a bit of a longer quote, and you write, "Mercy or unmerited love is the fuel for transparency, as I no longer need to run from regret." Now, you have much more sentences, but I like that. I love that. "Mercy is the fuel for transparency, as I no longer need to run from regret. I own my neuroses and failings. They do not own me. From that place, healing and reconciliation is possible. Mercy frees my heart to love and to live." Terry, that is just a great statement.
Thank you. I will tell you. I mean, I'm Christian, and one of the sad things about me is that kind of teaching comes more from our Buddhist brothers and sisters than it comes from Christian brothers and sisters.
Yeah. But it doesn't come from Jesus.
No, Jesus, of course, would have no problem with what I just said.
No, no.
But the way I was taught was that
right,
I needed to live with the shame of everything. And one of the breakthroughs for me, therapy wise, was a therapist who said, you know, for me not to run from all those things that I considered, quote, well, my neuroses, or what I consider detrimental to me being a, quote, successful and or together person. Those were just who I was. Those are who I'd be like you running from, in other words, standing up in front of 12 steps and said, "I'm an alcoholic, but not really, I'm just joking with you because I'm going to get past it. Don't worry about it."
Yeah. Yeah. That really is true. And, you know, and that's such a hard lesson for a young man, you
yeah.
know, it or for a young woman, either one. I mean, it is not a gender-specific issue.
And the thing is, the same with the 12-step thing is, once you embrace that part of you that is either, call it broken, call it neurotic, call it whatever, those parts of ourselves that are not according to whatever we thought our script was going to be, once we embrace those things, from there, we have the capacity to connect in ways that we had not even imagined before.
Absolutely, because when we own them, instead of them owning us, we have freedom. There is freedom.
100%.
There is freedom in ownership of my neuroses and failings, and just say that is part of life, and that is my road, that is on the road I am, and I learn from that and walk down. It's like in that movie, gosh, what was that movie with Jeremy Irons and Bob De Niro, where Bob De Niro was carrying that weight up the cliff, the weight of all of his, that represented right. all of his shame and all of his misactions, and Jeremy Irons cut the backpack off his back, and Robert De Niro was all of a sudden freed.
He
because those things were owning him. Now he owned himself.
Yes, and
the mission. That was the film. The mission.
The mission. And it's a wonderful thing is that once you do that, once you own that, it's not about making excuses anymore. It's a very liberating thing that I don't need to overcome that to make a difference. I don't need to overcome that to be a loving person. I don't need to overcome that to make life better for those around me.
Boy, that's a great way to close. I love that. But before we wrap up, Terry, I have to mention to our audience that you have a new book that just came out a couple of months ago titled This Is Life. Do you want to tell us more about that other than go out and buy the damn thing?
Go out. Yeah, we just have a couple minutes, Charlie. Go out and buy it. This is sponsored by my son, whose college bill is still due.
Well, what's it about? What is the life all about?
This is the life. That's the title of it, and it's about mindfulness. In other words, living in this moment, this life, a Catholic theologian years and years ago had a phrase called thisness. Thisness.
Oh, thisness. Yes.
Thisness. Thisness. And I like that. We're way back to the beginning of our conversation that we started an hour ago, which is about paying attention. That's thisness. So the book is about mindfulness and about accepting grace so we can put the scorecard down and living in the present moment. What are the ways that we are able to do that?
Boy, I'd encourage readers. Now, I know they can get the book on Amazon, but how would you prefer people get the book? Can't they order it from you?
Amazon or TerryHershey.com, or any of the other booksellers. But
yeah, great.
And it's audio, and it's also...
Is it? Yeah. And do you read it?
I read it, and it's Kindle, and I just learned in the book business that Kindle's only one option on having it on your screen. I guess there's all kinds of companies that do it. But
oh, okay.
I'm so
great.
Amish. I'm going to write a book about me being Amish.
Luddite. Yeah, hey.
No, I am.
Hey, Hirsch, thanks so much for spending time with me today. And I want to check out, I want to encourage everyone to check out your book and your always inspirational posts. I would encourage them to subscribe to Sabbath Moment, which can be found at TerryHershey.com. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And as usual, until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.